Richard Weisberg is a leading scholar in language, literature, and legal rhetoric, particularly in how the language of French law accommodated racism and terror in Vichy France during World War II. In the post-9/11 U.S., he has criticized lawyers for, in his words, pulling a Vichy in their attempts to justify American torture of alleged terrorists. Professor Weisberg holds the Walter Flersheimer Chair in Constitutional Law at the Cardozo School of Law. In his new book, In Praise of Intransigence, The Perils of Flexibility, he makes a case for intransigence in the face of injustice. It's published by Oxford University Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Richard Weisberg to our show today. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, if your book were called In Praise of Resolve or In Praise of Steadfastness, do you think people would shrug and say, sure, so? Does anything distinguish intransigence from being steadfast or resolute?
Intransigence is more of an overall attitude, I think. We do show resolve, all of us, I think, fortunately, from time to time about certain issues. Some of them are private. Some of them might be political. Some of them might be in the business world. We even maybe from time to time show righteousness. But the lexicon usually morphs these positive words into something negative. Righteousness becomes self-righteousness, and intransigence is a norm that I am hoping to show my readers is a positive one and that can work throughout their lives.
Is it distinct from resistance?
Wow. Sometimes it's insistence on preservation of the good, and we don't usually think of that as being a form of resistance. But yes, at other times, it's resistance to something that we think is wrong.
You've put intransigence in opposition to flexibility. Isn't flexibility usually thought of as a good thing?
Flexibility for about 98% of what we do in life is a good thing. The problem that I see and try to analyze is that flexibility has become a kind of norm. Flexibility itself has become a fighting faith. And that is problematic and has been problematic historically because people tend to cave instead of retaining what it is they think is right.
Well, there's flexibility in the sense of caving in and flexibility in the sense of compromise. Is there a big difference?
The two words are similar, and again, they have a very, very positive lineage, and they're very important even in the terms of my book, but not as a norm. They are a means to an end. Once you have decided, and this will happen, I think, in relatively few cases, once you've decided that for you something is extremely important to the point that you're going to be intransigent, stubborn, intractable, we have a lot of words, and I'm trying to revalue them positively, then nonetheless you will need to show even there a certain flexibility in working towards that goal.
Judge Bernard Shaw wrote, "The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man."
Beautifully put. There is something unreasonable about the idea of sticking to your guns, although that has not always been thought of as unreasonable.
Haven't people on both the far left and the far right been accused of being ideologically intransigent?
Yes, in our contemporary world, we are inclined to say there's too much. We don't usually say intransigence. There's too much extremism. Our discourse is too polarized. This is also, first of all, not necessarily true politically. It could be that one side, I call them the red staters in my book, meaning, let's say, the Republicans, are in fact intransigent, but the other side, although it has a considerable amount of power, call them the blue staters, call them the majority in the Senate, it could be that this group does not show a sufficient amount of intransigence in standing up to the intransigence of the other side.
Is the Tea Party being steadfast or obstructionist?
I disagree with just about everything there, though I don't disagree with them because they are being intransigent. A problem in looking at the Tea Party, but also at a lot of views that we don't agree with, is that we satisfy ourselves that we're fighting those views well enough simply by labeling them stubborn or intransigent. We shouldn't do this. We should oppose the views substantively with a certain amount of intransigence of our own.
Does intransigence on one side provoke intransigence on the other side? leading to gridlock?
Intransigence on one side should provoke intransigence on the other side more than it does. Example, the Republicans in the Senate for too many years, while the Democrats had the majority, in my view, were able to foist a kind of filibuster rule. I teach constitutional law, and I was surprised to hear that you needed 60 votes in the Senate. That was the result of Republican intransigence. It should have provoked intransigence from the Democrats. And a little bit lately, they're trying to do away with that. Instead, we saw too much flexibility.
Well, when the Democrats finally did break that down, Republicans said that they had broken faith with the Senate rules, and now see that as a reason to object to pretty much everything else that comes along.
The longer the intransigence of our enemies or our opponents, let's put it that way, the longer that intransigence continues and the more tactics they use, the better we have to be in deconstructing those tactics and coming up with something that will ultimately succeed.
Many Democrats opposed policies of the Bush administration, but then supported President Obama when he did the same thing, and vice versa with Republicans. Is that flexibility or party loyalty?
A little bit of both. I think it took a great deal of flexibility to go back to your opening question to me. It took, in my view, a lot of flexibility post 9/11 for a variety of practices to be accepted that prior to 9/11, really on 9/10 of 2001, were taboo across the board. One of these is torture. There were a number of other practices associated with Guantanamo. You're quite right to say, and this is unfortunate in my view, that this crossed party lines after the election of President Obama. However, that is a person that I feel is gradually trying to return us to a rule of law.
Are there intransigent individuals in the middle?
No, except in the following way. All of us, or at least the majority of us, are intransigently flexible. Flexibility has become a norm. We like to think of ourselves as always able to compromise, and this becomes a norm. And it's a norm that we stick to fiercely, and that's a very bad mistake when push comes to shove.
Some, like Antonin Scalia, might argue that they're steadfast in their originalist reading of the Constitution. Others champion an evolving, flexible Constitution. How do you see current constitutional debates or older ones like Brown versus Board of Education?
Well, there's a chunk of the book about five cases in which were all, in my view, wrongly decided. And since you mentioned Justice Scalia, the most recent of these cases is the D.C. versus Heller gun control case. I can't help but grinning a little bit because, of course, you're absolutely right to say that Scalia styles himself a textualist, which would mean that he has a certain inflexible or intransigent approach to the Constitution, which in my terms would not necessarily be bad, but he violates his textualism almost all the time. And therefore, in Heller, it was very difficult to work with the text of the Second Amendment and figure out that it was anything more than a protection of the state militia. He's a textualist, and he managed to work his way through so that now each of us has an individual right to self-defense and therefore to own and possess guns. That was an act of complete flexibility. It took him many, many pages, and it's authoritative because he got enough votes.
So it would have been better if he had been intransigent? I'm not sure what
yes,
the
because
and
in,
how would that
in
have,
my view of
manifested itself.
Right. In my view of constitutional law, we wrongly think that it is only the living constitutionalists, those who have gotten themselves away from original intent or text, who are doing the work that we need in the 21st century. Had Scalia actually been the textualist that he claimed that he was, D.C. versus Heller would have been decided differently. You cannot work with that text and wriggle your way towards an individual right to own arms.
Richard H. Weisberg holds a chair in constitutional law at Cardozo School of Law. His latest book, In Praise of Intransigence, The Perils of Flexibility, is published by Oxford University Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Professor Richard S. Weisberg. His book, In Praise of Intransigence, The Perils of Flexibility, is published by Oxford University Press. Who do you think are the most notable people historically who deserve praise but were instead condemned as intransigent?
The span I look at in the book is a long historical span going back 2,000 years. And in reverse chronological order, since we mentioned post-9/11 policies, there are people, even in the Bush administration, I would mention Philip Zelikow. There seem to be people who managed to buck the trend when all else are kind of caving in and folding their tents. And during World War II, I have three particular, I call them desk front heroes, because they weren't out there fighting or planting bombs, but three very influential people in Nazi Germany, in Vichy France, and in the British Channel Islands, which was occupied for 5 years, stood up intransigently against the shifting sands within their own colleagues towards Hitler's policies.
And you've written about Vichy France. You've got the Legion of Honor, despite the fact that hasn't French myths been that everybody was intransigent except for a few collaborators?
They intransigently hated me at first for both archival work that was bringing out some pretty shameful things, and then I started to litigate on behalf of Holocaust survivors. And the first important case that I was on was against French banks for spoliating Jewish assets. But then, and this is totally proves, I think, my point, if you stick to your guns, eventually even an intransigent other or opponent will come around. And then for 10 years, we worked together in a more diplomatic way.
On the other hand, weren't opponents of the Nazis imprisoned, executed? Were those who had concerns about the Nazis being flexible or cowardly or just going along with the crowd or understanding the way things were?
I think opponents on any level of the Nazis deserve great respect, and there were many stripes. There were many different categories of those people. The ones that I talk about, Abraham Lane on the island of Guernsey, who stood up when the authoritative group he was a part of were betraying British traditions to define and then persecute and victimize Jews. Professor Jacques Maury, who early in the game in Vichy France told his colleagues, we do not act this way as French people. We have our traditions. And Lothar Kreisig, who was a sitting judge in Nazi Germany in 1940 and from the bench protested the entire way in which Nazi law, such as it was, had been deformed and stopped allowing euthanasia remarkably late in the game in Nazi Germany. None of them was punished. And one of the things that I want my readers to know is that they probably have more power than they think, and that even the worst tyrants, much less the folks that we come up against, don't easily martyrize their opponents.
But there was a German clergyman who said, first they came after the labor unionists, and I didn't object because I wasn't a labor unionist. They came after the socialists. I didn't object because I wasn't a socialist. They came after the Jews. I didn't object because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came after me, and nobody was left to object.
Beautiful words.
I'm not exactly quoting it exactly
the
way
right.
He said it. But
it took a long time as those steps were taking place that he mentions. Unfortunately, the situation was getting much worse. The best time to try to strike out intransigently when you see that something that you and your community believe in deeply has been traduced or equivocated is at the beginning. Very few of us have the courage, but I think the historical examples indicate that we all have the opportunity.
You mentioned the use of torture. News organizations like the New York Times and NPR defended calling torture a harsh interrogation technique by saying that using the word torture would be prejudicial. Weren't they just abiding by the standards of objective journalism?
Changes of terminology are something we have to keep our eye on. So I very much like your question. Torture was on September 12th suddenly an open issue, whereas, as I said earlier, on September 10th, everybody thought that it was taboo. And one of the ways that we put something into play that shouldn't be in play because it represents a change in a very fine tradition is to change the definition or vocabulary. So torture really was ratcheted up in the early memos and then thereafter to a place where it almost had to be the infliction of death. And that's not, of course, traditionally what we mean by torture.
Law professor Alan Dershowitz advocated what he called torture warrants to force a kind of accountability. And he said they should be applied when there was a ticking bomb scenario. Many yeah. people saw it as kind of a fantasy situation.
In an early volume from my current publisher about torture, Dershowitz, myself, and about 15 other mostly law professors were debating the tactic. Very few people stood up intransigently for the idea that torture is wrong, and Dershowitz certainly didn't. Since then, we've deconstructed the ticking bomb hypothetical. It's an interesting hypothetical, but it's very, very difficult realistically to track the exact sequence of events which would lead to you're sitting in a room with the only person who has the answer to a bomb that might go off in Times Square.
Well, it's part of the problem, and part of the problem, as I saw once when in an interview with Dershowitz, was you have no guarantee that if that person knows, that person is going to give you the answer, tortured or not.
Right. Torture historically is not a truth developing device. It makes the torturer feel better, and if anything, it can lead to false statements to keep the pain off of the torturee.
Can simply calling an act harsh interrogation as opposed to torture make that act more likely to occur to somebody to do it?
Yes. I think as I track throughout my book about the etymologies and the synonyms and the antonyms for the word intransigence, words really do affect us. The way words are used really do affect audiences.
I still am not sure when I would apply intransigence. Would it be applied to whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning or Edward Snowden?
Intransigence exists. I can't opine on those two cases. Intransigence.
How about Galileo? Darwin?
Well, you know, Galileo did cave. Galileo is an enormously genial and superb individual. Eventually, he did cave into the pressures of the church, which I am not too sure I really hold against him.
Well, he was faced death.
Yeah, and I don't sit around sort of preaching or throwing stones at people who, under enormous pressure individually, give in. I'm interested in my readers, who I want to be, as a con law professor, you'll understand this. I want them to be informed citizens who also understand what their own powers are, however limited as individuals, their own options as groups when they see something wrong going on. I am interested in the corporate world, too. So the whistleblower example is interesting, just as recently what happened with Donald Sterling in the NBA. Who intransigently was opposed by the head of the NBA, Adam Rosen. And it was because of Rosen's intransigence, in my view, that the intransigence of Sterling and his racism were, of course, we don't know exactly how it's going to play out, but things are looking good because a corporate figure decided to be intransigent.
About Thomas Paine, John Adams said, without the pen of the author of Common Sense, the Sword of Washington would have been raised in vain, but Paine was ridiculed by the time he died. In fact, stoned, I think, when he returned to Philadelphia. Teddy Roosevelt referred to him as that filthy little atheist. So history changes its attitudes about people who have been intransigent?
Well, very few intransigent people gain honor in their own generation because most of us, and this is a risk I want a flexibility that I want people to be aware of. Most of us get annoyed with people who are expressing positions that we actually share but are not acting on. And I think this happened during the McCarthy period. There really is a risk among the flexible that when they see an intransigent person actually saying what they know deep down is the right thing, they're going to dislike them. And you mentioned Thomas Paine, but exactly 50 years ago, and for me this is an odd kind of political insertion, exactly 50 years ago, Barry Goldwater, in his nomination speech, said, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, and moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue." That was it. He lost that election.
But that sounds intransigent to me.
It is intransigence. And it forever, at least for our generations, it put intransigence again into a bad light. But at the same time, Martin Luther King was saying, the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be.
Why do you feel unable or reluctant to opine about Snowden or Manning?
I need a little bit more information. Snowden, I'm willing to take the step of saying that a whistleblower who is essentially telling the truth, that is, that the data that's being revealed is truthful, and that secondarily, and I'm not sure we know this for 100%, is not putting troops in the field at risk, should not be subject to the World War I Espionage Act. He should be brought back, and if there is punishment involved, it should not be that old act which has done so much harm, and I talk about that in the book, over the period since World War I.
I'm speaking with Richard Weisberg, who is he is the Walter Florsheimer Chair in Constitutional Law at the Cardozo School of Law. His latest book, In Praise of Intransigence, The Perils of Flexibility. You're a specialist in law and literature. Are there great literary examples of a kind of noble or moral intransigence? Billy Budd, perhaps?
Billy Budd, let's just say I put three kids through college talking about Billy Budd, so we would need another show, but I'd love to. The ones that I think what happens is you have a false intransigence in that book by Captain Vere, which results in the death of Billy needlessly. Vere was being very flexible with the law, but he proclaimed to his handpicked court that he had no choice but to hang Billy. In fact, we find out he had plenty of choices. In the book, I deal with stories from the Bible up through William Faulkner via Shakespeare and Susan Glass Bell. I think stories are a huge influence on us. And they set the case of intractability versus flexibility more beautifully than I or anybody else could.
In Robert Bolt's play, A Man for All Seasons, Thomas More insists on hearing the language of the new oath to determine whether he can take it. He's being intransigent. My reading of history is Thomas More is a more complicated character than just simply a hero of intransigence.
Very complicated, super smart, but he was a figure who throughout his career stood up for the law. And that is admirable. He stood up for the law as he sought to be the good. And he would not compromise that. Now, he did remain silent. And people might criticize him for that. His family didn't like the fact that he was being intransigent. Intransigence does not work within the family, and I'm not preaching it. You cannot be intransigent within the family. But he felt strongly enough about things in a very noble way, to have stuck to his principles.
Is a certain kind of intransigence necessary when the dominant way of thinking is facing a challenge to subvert the dominant paradigm, as Thomas Kuhn might have said and then later wished he hadn't?
Yeah, he did. I think If you are subverting, I think earlier you put it, if you are rebelling or responding in a way, resisting, I think was your word, if you're resisting a status quo that is in your mind, in having thought about it, not purely acting from the gut, although some gut is involved in almost every act of intransigence, you've thought about it, and you think that the status quo is wrong, yes, it's then incumbent on you, choosing your issues very carefully, to resist. Most of what I talk about in the book, however, is a falling off, a situation of a falling off from a prior good that is occurring because of some new situation, usually styled an emergency. We have to be really especially on our guard when we are told that there is an emergency going on, because when that happens, everything seems to be negotiable.
Is contemporary neuroscience or behavioral science shedding any light on what's going on in our brains when we remain steadfast or when we become more flexible?
I talk about this a little bit, and there is a recent writer that I like very much, Elaine Scarry, talks about it at greater length in a book called Thinking in an Emergency, which is such a great topic because generally our brain makes us feel like deer caught in the headlight when there's an emergency. But there are ways of actually training ourselves to get away from that. There's also been a lot of work lately about Sully Sullenberger. Here's a guy who, prior to saving all those lives, and imagine what must have been going through his mind as the plane descends on the river, you can practice it. And I actually think that in an age of almost infinite flexibility, I'm asking my readers to actually practice what I call flexophobia, which is a fear of infinite flexibility.
Sully Sullenberger has never flown a plane since and claims he had PTSD as a result of that experience. So intransigence can also have other kinds of effects on us physically and emotionally and mentally.
It's never easy.
Richard Weisberg will be speaking with Stanley Fish at Cardozo Law School tonight at 6 o'clock. That's at 55 Fifth Avenue. You can find RSVP by going to our show page at WNYC.org. His book is called In Praise of Intransigence, The Perils of Flexibility, published by Oxford University Press. Thanks so much.